Welcome to an hour of Voices Without Frontiers, hosted by CJSF-FM in Burnaby, British Columbia, Canada. We are presenting items in English from three radio stations in North America, CKUT in Montreal, CFRO, also known as Co-op Radio, in Vancouver, and KPFA in Berkeley, California. First up, here's an interview from Red Eye, the venerable collective at Co-op Radio, conducted by Jane Williams. It's about classism with respect to jobs and intelligence.
Here's Jane Williams.
Lots of women and some men have waited tables at some point in their lives. If you have, you'll know how challenging a job it is. You have to stretch the limits of short-term memory. You have to balance plates and cups on your arms. You have to move around quickly and efficiently in a crowded space. Yet we're used to thinking of waitressing as unskilled work. You don't need to use your brain to do it. Mike Rose challenges the notion of mindless labor in his new book, The Mind at Work. He talked to carpenters, plumbers, and hairdressers, among others, and documents the intellectual demands they face daily in their jobs. Mike Rose is a professor of education at UCLA. He's also the son of a waitress and the nephew of a welder and a foreman. Mike Rose joins me this morning from California. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jane.
In the introduction to the book now, you say that you've been thinking about intelligence and how we measure it for a long time. Why is that? What is it about that topic, this topic that fascinates you?
Well, you know, I grew up watching the display of competence and ability and intelligence all around me. And then when I found myself in my professional life as a teacher and then a professor of education, I was increasingly concerned about some of the easy attributions about ability and competence that we tend to make as a culture about folks who do blue-collar and service work. And so this book is a kind of convergence, I guess, of those two parts of my life.
Now, right at the beginning of the book, in the introduction, you say that you grew up witness to the intelligence of the waitress. What is the nature of the thought that goes into being a good waitress?
The waitresses I observed and talked to, and that included my mother, by the way, and then all the work I was able to find done by psychologists on the memories of bartenders and waiters and waitresses, all of it leads me to think that the efficient waitress is, first of all, is, as you say, able to really hold a lot of things in short-term memory, you know, who ordered what regulars typically like what things done to their food and what they like with it. So there's a lot of memory work, keeping things in memory as you're moving through your station. But also as you're moving through your station, as you pointed out, there's a lot going on. So the good waitress is able to pull different tasks together. She's able to rank order them, if you will, on the fly and think about, gosh, what can I do while I'm back at this particular part of the station? As one waitress put it, so that you're not running back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, which would just tire you out and be inefficient. So there's a lot of grouping tasks and prioritizing them.
I identify very much with the section about waitressing because I did waitress part-time for 7 years, and so I can really testify to the intellectual demands that are required to do that job.
Another quality that I found really interesting is, I guess, what you could call a vigilance. Cognitive psychologists would call it the attending, and that is the good waitress just is alert to things. You know, she's seen who dropped a fork or who's signaling to get some extra mustard or something. She's also, and my mother, I thought, had a really nice take on this, she's also just sort of alert to what's going on in her station. So, for example, if somebody ordered a shrimp plate and that customer seems to be sitting there for longer than it should take for that order to be prepared, a little flag goes up in her head, right? Did something go wrong in the kitchen? So she'll check on that. Now, all of this, especially at rush hour, is going on in the midst of a lot of action. So there's all these demands on your mind going on simultaneously. In addition to all that, though, clearly the waitress's income depends on her tips. So she has to have a pleasing presence, and this is where we get into the whole business of service and how appealing was the service. And people tend to talk about that just in terms of personality or maybe emotion or somebody's pleasing, But if you think about it, that takes a lot of thought, too. I mean, being able to read social cues, being able to balance and negotiate people's emotions. You know, do you have a grumpy regular customer on the same day that the cook's in a bad mood? And how are you going to handle returned orders? And, you know, all of that calls for a kind of social intelligence, if you will.
Now, you spent some time in a high school woodworking class. What kind of intellectual skills come into play when people are learning to build objects in wood?
Right. Certainly, memory comes into play, as we saw with the waitress, and certainly the ability to kind of work smart, right, to group and rank order what you can do when. But as I watch these young people master the rudiments, anyway, of the carpenter's trade, the first thing you notice is the whole business of tool use and learning how to use tools, not only use them well, but know when and how to use them. You know, what's the right tool for a particular job? And as people get better at using tools, then how can you improvise? You know, if you watch the good mechanic or the good carpenter, when they don't have a tool, a particular tool that they need, they're often able to use an existing tool to make something happen. So certainly all the business that surrounds the learning as well as the effective use of tools is, I think, demanding. And as well, of course, you, as a carpenter, begin to learn the steps of assembly. If you're a cabinet maker, let's say, and at first when you're learning these things, there's a lot of kind of conscious thought involved. And even the simplest of tasks could involve 100 or more steps if you broke that task down. And for the young person learning, that's what has to happen. As the carpenter gets more mature, he or she then is able to perhaps group some of those steps together or function more efficiently. It certainly goes faster. But there, then, another thing kicks in, another intellectual thing kicks in, and that's this whole business of planning and anticipating, visualizing. I was watching a carpenter put in some French doors in a house, and this was in a fairly constrained space, and these were sliding French doors. So he's standing back, and he's looking at the space, and all the pieces are laying out on the floor. And so I asked him to just kind of talk out loud, you know, what was going on? I could see that he was ruminating on this whole business. And it turned out that a number of things were going on, and as he put it, he was trying to see it in his mind. So he's picturing all the pieces of these doors coming together in assembly, and he's wondering, he's trying to imagine what might go wrong as part of the doors, the panels, are sliding over the stationary parts that might create a problem. Also, he's thinking about the threshold on the outside of the doors and how it's got to be at a particular angle if the rain's going to run off it. While he's doing all this, he's noticing that the casing for the inside of the door is wider than the other woodwork in this room, and that he's going to have to do something to refashion that, otherwise it's going to be aesthetically unpleasant. So all of this stuff going on simultaneously in his mind I found to be really interesting. And the final thing to say, and I guess everybody would recognize this, is that there's mathematics involved in all this. I mean, and not just the simple mathematics of measurement, but a kind of material geometry, if you will, where congruence and symmetry and proportion and the properties of angles and all that come into play. So these were some of the things, Jane, that I saw going on when I was watching these young carpenters learn their trade.
Now, there's a lot of talk among the tradespeople, both the experienced ones and the ones who are learning, about the look of a thing. You hear electricians talking about an installation that was pretty, and they actually use the word pretty, or changing something just because it was ugly. And these would be wires that are hidden in the wall and that nobody is going to see except another electrician. Were you surprised to hear aesthetic judgments about this kind of work?
Well, that's so interesting that you bring that up, because in fact it was one of the pleasant surprises of this study was just how ever-present aesthetic concerns were. And it seemed to me that there were at least a couple reasons for that. One is the thing that looks good is also built well. And in a way, maybe you could anticipate that. But what was a bit surprising to me was how often folks would just put a little extra effort into something or even redo it, not because it wasn't functional or sound, but because it just didn't look pretty, as one person put it. Or as another guy put it, he said, it's just too ugly, and he redid something. You know, Jane, what struck me, too, as I was doing this work and thinking about it, is how we often sell short that aspect of work. I mean, when we think about aesthetics and appearance, too often I think we think of, you know, just the arts. And in fact, it seems to me that we're really aesthetic beasts, you know, that this concern about some kind of harmony or symmetry or clean lines, it just runs throughout what we do, and I certainly saw it in all kinds of places.
Now, your Uncle Joe worked at General Motors, eventually working his way up to foreman. And you quote him as saying that there's no such thing as unskilled work. That's an unusual comment when you think of a car factory assembly line. What did he mean by that?
You know, I mean, it's typical in the way jobs are categorized to talk about unskilled, semi-skilled, and skilled. And clearly the cabinet maker's job involves a whole set of skills and a knowledge base that is different from, took longer to develop than the ability to shovel dirt out of a ditch, right? But my uncle's point, I think, was really a good one, and that is that no matter how rudimentary the job may seem, for example, the job he started out doing, which was called wet sanding, basically a water hose and a piece of sandpaper, and all day what you did was smooth out the chassis, the bodies of these cars that were about to be painted. And that was considered the least skilled job at the factory. And yet what he pointed out was is that they were good at this, developed a whole set of routines that were really efficient and effective. They had so many swipes that they would take the paper over one part of the car versus another part of the car. There was a certain kind of finesse, if you will, that they developed. And that was the point he was making, that even that calls for the development of a certain ability if you're going to be able to do the work without killing yourself and if you're able to do it effectively. So I thought it was a really nice point that he made.
Now, you also spent some time in a very different world, that of surgeons. Why did you decide to do some research there?
Well, you know, the purpose of the mind at work is to demonstrate the fact that all this work that surrounds us takes more thought than we tend to grant it. But there's a bigger purpose to the book, too, and that is to try and get us to just think in a harder way about what we mean by intelligence or how we categorize whole classes of people as being smarter or less smart than others based on the kind of work they do. And then to raise even further questions about, you know, whether or not that's good for the culture. So it occurred to me that one way maybe to help shine some light on this business of the, you know, this troubling business for me of the distinctions we make between quote-unquote manual work and quote-unquote mental work, that one of the ways to maybe get into that from a different angle was to look at people who do use their hands but are highly respected and get paid quite well and whose work is considered to be very high status. So I spent a summer with surgeons, and it was very interesting because here is work that everybody is a very highly demanding, high IQ kind of work, demands medical school and all that knowledge that they gain from the books of anatomy and physiology and biology and human biology and that. But what was so interesting is that as you actually watch the work being done, it was such a nice mixture of both the quote-unquote mental and the quote-unquote manual that it really led you to just realize that you can't make that separation, that the manual is the mental and the mental is the manual. And so it's the same thing I saw with carpenters. It's the same thing I saw with hairstylists, that these neat distinctions that we make, Jane, are just not that neat when you actually get in close to the work.
There's a part in the book where you're watching a surgeon, you're listening to him talk about you need to get a feel for the tissue and how the tissue is moving, and you say, that made me think of the plumber who has to see with his fingers. And I thought, well, that's a deeply radical kind of a remark.
Well, I'm glad you think it is, because I was hoping it to be that. You know, that Look, I'm not trying to say something silly here. I mean, if I need to have some kind of medical work done, I'm going to go to a surgeon and not to a plumber. I know that. But the ability to develop a refined tactile sense that is combined with a set of ideas, in other words, what something feels like means something, and it has a body of knowledge that it taps into, that happens with plumbers and it happens with surgeons. And I think that we would do well to recognize that some of these abilities are spread across occupations more than we tend to think.
What are, do you think, the long-term consequences for a society that really does look down on manual workers and think that they're not smart people?
I think it matters actually on several planes, you know. One is I just think we should have an accurate representation of what different kinds of work entail. I think that's important. But, you know, if you think that people aren't that capable or that the work they do doesn't require that much, then that's going to determine the way you organize work, the way you train people, the way you educate them. But also, I think it's just not good for a democracy. It's not good for civic life for a whole bunch of us to assume that a whole other bunch of us, by the work they do, are not that capable.
Now, you are in the faculty of education. What are the lessons for educators in all this?
It would certainly affect the way we think about school and schooling, things like vocational and technical education. And some of those discussions have been going on in the United States, I know, for a while. And I think on a theoretical level, too, for folks like me, I think it forces us to just think a little bit harder about intelligence and how easily we tend to assume things about intelligence based on the work people do or the kinds of lives they lead. But I think it has also broader consequences for just the way we talk about this business of using our minds.
I've been speaking with Mike Rose. He's a professor of education at UCLA. His book is titled The Mind at Work, and it's published this year by Viking. You've been listening to a program produced by Red Eye, an alternative media collective which broadcasts on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM, in Vancouver, Canada.
Thanks to Co-op Radio for that piece. Now here's a short, lively story by Lonnie Shavelson from California.
In 2001, an African-American woman named Afia Walkingtree ducked her head under low beams in the basement of an old wood house in Oakland, California. And that's when Harriet Tubman spoke to her. The famed freer of slaves told Walkingtree that this basement would be a new station on the Underground Railroad. Walkingtree started a school for African drumming called Spirit Drums, so the music of her ancestors, silenced in the first underground, would be set free.
Harriet made people believe they deserved freedom. When I teach the drums to the women and youth, my primary goal is affirming that they deserve to be heard, to be liberated.
The Underground Railroad was, fundamentally, an alliance between enslaved Africans and white people who sheltered and escorted them to freedom. Under dire circumstances, blacks and whites trusted each other. And so it must be in Oakland, says Walkingtree, an alliance of all races drumming together.
Harriet showed up and said, "The way we were able to liberate our peoples was that we found allies. Remember that everyone is your ally, and that is what will liberate us."
Walkingtree says that Harriet Tubman carried slaves to freedom, but that was just the beginning of the job.
Even 140 years after slavery, there are still people who are starving. Starving for food, starving for education, starving for jobs, starving spiritually. And it's happening in Oakland, on my street. So Harriet Tubman's work is not finished.
Walkingtree says she's bringing women of all backgrounds together to drum and to talk about race. But the racial separation and distrust in the Oakland Underground can seem as large as in Harriet Tubman's times.
A woman of African descent said, "Look, I don't want to drum with white people. I just want this to be our space."
I am Laurie McWhorter. I'm a white woman. Some women of African heritage have talked about how it's really hard to be in class with white women. These drums have been taken away from their people already, and it's hard to have white people appropriating them again.
I am Shawnee Lee. I am African American. There are times when Black women just want to drum with Black women to talk amongst your own people. We just want to drum amongst ourselves.
From Walking Tree's point of view, and she would say Harriet Tubman's, the racial separation at Oakland's Underground moves back and forth, from white guilt and fear to Black anger and fear.
If you're drumming and you don't have feelings come up around race or class or privilege, whether you're Latina, American Indian, Asian, Black, or white woman, you're not feeling. African women are scared to pick up the drum because of the fear that you're going to get shamed, you're going to get beat. It is memory. It's going to separate us. It's going to continue to separate us.
Walking Tree says that the racial separation the drummers talk about is one step up from the silent segregation in our schools, at work, in our homes. The difference at the Underground, she says, is the dialogue.
In Harriet's time, the conversation was about, we gotta get north. And so the emotional conversation about, well, how do we walk together, that's the conversation we're having today. We stop and have the conversation.
From the Oakland station of the Underground Railroad, this is Lonnie Shavelson.
Thanks, Lonnie, for that audio. We close this hour of Voices Without Frontiers with an excerpt from one of Canada's most interesting syndicated programs, Native Solidarity News, at CKUT-FM, Radio McGill in Montreal, Quebec.
What's happening to us up there is genocide, and it's happening right here in Canada.
Welcome once again to Native Solidarity News, national radio service, and part of an international network of information and action in support of Indigenous peoples' survival and dignity. We're all volunteers committed to promoting Native self-determination culturally, economically, spiritually, and otherwise. Produced at CKUT Community Radio since 1996, NSN is now also broadcast on over 20 stations across Canada. This week we'll be joined by Arthur Manuel, an international representative for the Skekwekwelt Protection Center, and Janice Billy of the Sekompec Protection Center.
On Sunday, August 29th, a group of nearly 200 Native and non-Native demonstrators led by grassroots SWEPMEC activists took to the sprawling Sun Peaks ski resort to protest the expansion of the Mini Whistler and its centerpieces, the Delta Hotel, and the incipient golf course. Seems like nothing brings out anti-Indian racism to the fore like golf, or maybe whales or fish. The Israelis pretend they're fighting over tombs, walls, and archaeological excavations. We pretend in Canada that we're after a wicked back nine, or for Luna the Arca to be back with his pod. And in both cases, massive land grabs and dispossessions get wrapped in layers of religious, legal, and political harshness to conceal the simple fact that brown-skinned people who were there first are obstacles to the grand design, Canadian brand colonialism, or the 2010 Olympics. Take your pick. This comes from an article published in Seven Oaks Magazine of Politics, Culture and Resistance. We're joined on the line by Janice, who is a spokesperson with the campaign Resisting the Sun Peaks Expansion in British Columbia. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Can you tell us a bit about this weekend's activities? There was a massive convergence there that is helping to establish a protection center in the center of Sun Peaks.
Yes, there was, and we really appreciate the support. We had a number of people come from a lot of different support groups, as well as our own grassroots people here and traditional elders. And they joined with us in demonstrating our opposition to the ongoing expansion project at the Sun Peak Ski Resort. And we are building the protection center because we really need protection. We're being driven off or forcibly removed from our homelands, our traditional use areas, and it's genocide. Like, what's happening to us up there is genocide, and it's happening right here in Canada. What they're doing is they're right in our traditional territory. It's one of it was a pristine alpine mountain area. It's a really important area traditionally, and still is today, that where people went and we collected our food, our moose, deer, medicines, berries, and practiced our spirituality in the mountains. And it's been severely destroyed by the Sun Peak Ski Resort, by massive ski lifts, hotel development, condominiums, and it's basically it's a land grab. It's not really about skiing. It's about the Japanese owner from Japan purchasing land for like 5,000 acres, subdividing them into these tiny little lots and selling them for up to $60,000 a lot. And there's a lot of foreign ownership up there.
There was a convergence called for Native activists as well as non-Natives to participate in coming to the Sun Peaks resorts and doing something to stop the expansion.
I and some other really important traditional elders were restricted from, we had court-ordered restrictions from being up that area, from the Sun Peaks area for 1 year, and they expired on June 20th, so we were able to go back this weekend. But throughout that year, we spent all our energy going to speaking events and contacting support groups and informing people about our struggle. And people initially started supporting us, too, based on an environmental issue because they're concerned about the environment, too. But when they learn how important that environment is to us as Indigenous people and also about the outstanding land issue, then they really they understand and then they really support us on all issues.
The outstanding land issues that you brought up and that continue to be part of the resistance to Sun Peaks expansion continues to be part of a debate going on in British Columbia. It's entered the elections, at least during the last election campaign. Where do you see the status of the issues around land rights for you and for everyone fighting against Sun Peaks development? Where do you see the issues of land rights coming back towards Native people and coming out of the hands of developers? Is it happening yet?
Well, first of all, in BC and British Columbia, all the Indigenous people have never, ever signed treaties, have never been conquered in war, have never sold their land, have never ceded their lands in any way. And I know there's been a modern-day treaty, the Nisga Treaty, and maybe a few on Vancouver Island. But other than that, BC is all unceded land. And the province, however, has taken control, assumed ownership somehow, without any legal purchase, and continue on the development and expansion and stealing the land for development, for settlement, for mining, forestry, tourism, everything. And even though there have been some really important court cases, which Arthur Manuel will talk about, even the Constitution of Canada has recognized Aboriginal title and rights, and recent court decisions like the Haida that says the corporations and the government has to consult and accommodate us, which has never happened in the Sun Peaks case. Now, there are two Native bands who are doing small deals with them, like they went into partnership with Sun Peaks for staff housing, a small building for staff housing. But again, that was never, even the chiefs didn't consult the people when they did that. So the ordinary person has never been consulted or involved in any of this development.
Now, the issues of development on Indigenous lands is an ongoing concern. What is the status of that issue in British Columbia, given that you've had the opportunity to go around and speak to people about what's happening at Sun Peaks with expansion? Are people ready to step up and challenge these expansion and these developments when they happen on Native land?
Well, this weekend was a really good example of that because, like I said, we had about 200 people there with us, and we had a lineup of really strong speakers who understand the issue and totally support us and spoke to the people, and I think it was a really good education experience for people. And like I said, when they know the issue, they support us and because of what we believe, and they totally support us. So I think the key is to educate people about, you know, the land issue, the environment, the land issue, and how we're affected by it. And I think they will continue to support us. And we say all what we're doing is not just for us, but it's for all people, to protect the land for all people and all future generations.
And a protection center was built this weekend to help ensure that process. Do you want to tell us a bit about that action, what took place?
Okay, well, we cut down some trees on what they call crown land, which is actually our land. We cut down some trees without a permit from the Minister of Forest. They were just small little trees. And then right up the road from us, there's a huge pile of logs that were cut by them. But anyway, and they had these huge excavators, bulldozers, and our equipment was two shovels and a small power saw. and hand saws. That's what we were using. Anyway, we started construction of this building, and we started construction. The police were observing us. They didn't do anything, but we started on Sunday afternoon, and we had the structure up the wall, the poles, and then about 6:30, an official from the BC Air, Land, and Water Corporation. They're the branch of the government that distributes and sells Crown land, what they call Crown land. She came, escorted by two RCMP officers on each side of her, walking down the road to where we were, and delivered a trespass notice to us under Section 60 of the Land Act. One of the things it said is we had to be out of there by 8 p.m., but naturally we didn't obey the order, and we're still up there.
And what's coming up for the future with this protection center? What's the hopes for it?
Well, probably we'll be issued a seizure notice, which we've had in the past. We've had these trespass and seizure notices before. What they do with the seizure notice is they come down and destroy and take everything, and that's happened to us in the past when they destroyed a permanent home and two sacred sweat lodges at McGilvery Lake. The provincial government, Sun Peaks and BCAL and the RCMP, they all collaborate. The RCMP protects the workers. They protect the Sun Peaks workers. They protect the government officials, and they all work against us. Another example is when we got into where we were going to be, we were driving in there with our vehicles, and then they come with their big equipment and block the road off, and those workers are guarded by the police again. And I said, if we blocked the roads, we'd be in jail so fast. But they're allowed to block roads.
Given the continued repression that you're describing there at the hands of the police, what are your expectations for this protection center, and what do you hope that people, whether they're in British Columbia or here in Montreal, what do you hope that they're able to contribute to this ongoing effort?
Well, if people are able to locally contribute, we could appreciate help in our building. We always need food donations, cash donations for our legal defense fund. And a really important thing that people far away could do is a really intense letter-writing campaign to the Premier of BC and Attorney General Jeff Plante, because those are the people who are forcibly driving us off our land. They're the ones that get the court orders, send out these trespass notices to forcibly remove us from our lands. And when you do that, that's cultural genocide, because even though we're living in our present-day reserves, we still practice our traditional way of life. We still hunt, gather our foods from the mountains, and all of those things have to take place in the mountains. We can't be hunting down here on the reserve or picking berries on the reserve. All of those things are in the mountains. And another important thing about the protection center, besides informing people of our issues, is that it's a learning center, cultural learning center. We have elders there who teach the young people about plant recognition, which medicines are good to take, and a deer, how to get a deer, cut it up and smoke it, and about the land rights, and all of those things are teachings that are taking place at these places we build, because the elders are 65, 70, 80. They're the last generation of people that truly know the language and the way of our people, and if that's not passed on, all that knowledge will be lost. So these places are set up for that, and at McGilvery Lake was a prime example, because when we constructed the house, they were also learning a lot of self-sufficiency skills, like building a building, and outdoor survival, how to survive out in the land, you know, without electricity and everything. And at McGilvery Lake, in our culture, the men and women have sweat lodges separate. An elder man came up and an elder woman, and they built the two separate sweat lodges for the males and females, and taught them. A lot of these are youth who lost that connection or never had grandparents or somehow have to reconnect back to their culture. So that's what happened. And then those were demolished by Sun Peaks and the provincial government. And the next morning, there were groomed cross-country ski trails right where the sweat lodges had been. So they have absolutely no respect for our culture, our religion, our way of life. Like, absolutely none. It's like the bombing of the temples in Iraq.
Tell us a bit more about that. You brought up Iraq, and in the article that I started with from Seven Oaks, mm-hmm. again, there's been a bit of media coverage of this weekend's action, a number of reports in the mainstream media, but also several reports in the independent media. If you'd like to see some of those reports, or if you'd like more updates, you can check out the Anti-Poverty Committee's website at apc.resist.ca. The article that I was reading from concludes with the notion, actually just a short report from an event that took place earlier this summer in Vancouver. There was some type of meeting about the Olympic Games and Vancouver's bid to host those games. There were a number of people attending that delegation protesting outside of that meeting, saying this is stolen land, as the delegates left that meeting about the Olympic Games. Some people were holding placards that read Palestine 2010, giving an indication that Palestine and the issues happening in British Columbia have many similarities.
Yes, we've been meeting with young Palestinians, and it's exactly the same thing. Like, they build their houses, they're torn down, and they're blocked off from certain places. You know, they set up roadblocks against them, and it's marginalized, driven from their homelands. It's the exact same situation that's happening here in Kamloops, British Columbia. So another way people can help is just boycott those places, boycott the Delta, and say, this is what you're doing. You're committing genocide, just like people talk about Iraq and Palestine, but that's happening right here. You know, and local people have to know what they elect these governments. They have to know what these governments are doing.
Again, the resistance in Sun Peaks continues. For more information and updates, you can check out apc.resist.ca. There you can follow links for updates of what's happening. There's a big graphic in the center of the page that says Resistance Without Reservations. Click right around there for updates. Janice, you're encouraging people to write letters to boycott Delta Hotels.
Sun Peaks Ski Resort. And another good thing would be investment to a campaign against the investors that are buying properties. A lot of them are from California, Florida, Washington, Oregon. Like, I'm sure it's not the local Kamloops people who can afford to buy those places and build those places up Sun Peaks. It's foreign ownership.
Janice, I want to thank you very much for joining us on the program.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Janice.
Okay.
Working to stop development at Sun Peaks Resort. Arthur Manuel submitted documents at the international level to protest the environmental impacts and lack of indigenous economic interest at Sun Peaks.
Since that action took place at the end of August, there's been further information about court injunctions against Sun Peaks. Can you talk about what's going on in the last few weeks?
Yeah, the Sun Peaks sought an injunction on Friday, September 3rd, 2004, and we went down there. It was an ex parte injunction, basically. They wanted to appear on their own, so we appeared nevertheless because we heard about it. Janice had talked to J.J. Hunter, the lawyer for Sun Peaks. He advised us of the specific time once we sort of got a hold of them. Anyways, they actually did get an injunction against the 8th Squawkwaw Protection Center at Sun Peaks, which basically means that the injunction prohibits the occupation by Indian people and their supporters anywhere in the base, Sun Peaks base land area, which is a fairly substantive area. That's the area that Sun Peaks buys under private property from the province at a very cheap rate because it is a sort of payoff for investing money in the leased land, which is the ski hill. So they get this cheap land at the bottom of the hill for investing in the ski hill. And then they turn around. In this case, this injunction was to allow Frank Quinn, a lawyer and investor, to create 60 condominiums and 48 townhouses. And the average sort of condominium goes for $255,000. So that's $15 million in sales he'll make. And the average townhouse at Sun Peaks is for $445,000, which makes it $21 million. So the total amount of sales that this injunction was designed to provide support for was $36 million. So, and they didn't take into consideration any of our economic, indigenous economic interests, despite the fact that we raised it, because we defended our own selves because we didn't have any money for legal counsel. So we, Irene Billy, one of our elders, and Sarah Denault, another elder, spoke, and Janice Billy, and Arnie Jack, and myself, we represented ourselves, and I think we did a very good job in terms of getting the message across that there were indigenous economic interests there at the Hill, that we even raised the fact that the Indigenous Network on Economies and Trade made submissions to the World Trade Organization and had got accepted briefs, which basically said that the federal government's position of not recognizing Aboriginal title is a caste subsidy to the forest industry. So we were, you know, and that the WTO, even though it's a remote and one of the highest financial institution tribunals around in this sort of free capitalist system, anyways, did recognize that Indigenous people do have international economic interests, yet this court failed to do that. All they looked at was Frank Quinn and Darcy Alexander and Sun Peaks' $36 million condo townhouse development, and they backed them up and just totally failed to recognize the fact that we owned the land, and that the land that they were building this these condos on houses are is stolen land. So you know, that's just how the injunctive relief system works in this country. It's the legal mechanism in which developers and real estate agents can outmaneuver and beat Indian people. I know at the Haida case, the Supreme Court of Canada, the federal government argued that Indian people could always resort to injunctive relief. They did their remedy. But then one of the lawyers from our side said the last 20 injunctive remedies that we were involved in, we lost all of them. So I guess this is the 21st.
It's obviously not the first time that people resisting Sun Peaks expansion have been at the court level trying to just continue the effort to stop this development project. What's the current status of the effort on the ground? Is there still a presence there at the development site?
Yes, there is, and we're not doing this in any way in contempt as far as we're concerned. I know the people up there are really genuine. They're very concerned about the impact that these 60 condominiums and 48 townhouses are going to have on the McGilvery Creek watershed, and it's really a mess up there right now in terms of the environment, and there are people that stayed there, so of them people from the Nisqually that are there, and they've stayed at the center. The police did come in. They came in with a bailiff, and they read the court order, and they left, and they haven't been back since to enforce the order. But I expect them to either today or tomorrow. And the decision if people get arrested isn't mine. I would never, ever, ever, ever ask anybody to be arrested. In fact, in most cases, well, in all cases, I always ask them not to be arrested, that they should try and consider the consequences and what will be the legal arguments that we can use, especially in cases like contempt or in cases like trespass and different ones. They have different status, and we tell them, like, you need to evaluate your situation in that relationship, because whatever your decision is, we will stand behind you because we know you're not criminals. We know you're not doing this for your own personal benefit, and that you really have commitment to the land. But I always leave it up to them to make a decision. And so I don't really know what the decision of the Suwapmuk that are there, but they definitely will have my support when the time comes. And I know the RCMP have said they would be calling me whenever they decide they're going to go there and arrest the people. Normally I attend those tragic kind of situations, and they're really quite heart-breaking to see the RCMP used by the provincial government and by the federal government, because policing is really important to our Indian communities for regular criminal investigations, and we've had serious problems. Like in Kamloops, there was a murder between a couple of young Native people, and the investigation was badly botched by the RCMP, and I think to a certain extent because of the frustration that exists there. You know, so there is real serious criminal matters that need to be dealt with, and they really lose a lot of credibility and trust as police when the Attorney General of British Columbia and the Department of Justice use them to settle outstanding Indian land issues, you know, because those Indian land issues with regard to the size of Sun Peaks is really an Indian policy issue, because we do have Aboriginal title. The Supreme Court recognizes that, and the government should set up a mechanism where we can decide whether it should be 6,000 bed units the way it is, or it should proceed an extra 10,000 like phase two, these new 60 to 48 developments are going to be, you know, part of. And they don't do that, you know, and they won't address this thing through a legitimate sort of kind of genuine negotiating process. What do they do with the RCMP? They use them as Indian agents on outstanding land issues. And when you see that, and you see the Indian people genuinely struggling to protect the Mother Earth, and the police are in there arresting them and taking them off to jail, it's really tragic to be in those situations. And you hear the drummers singing and all this. And so that's the situation that it is right now. We're just waiting for that to happen.
Art, can you talk about the support that this effort to stop the expansion of Sun Peaks development, the support that you've gotten from non-Native communities, and the support that you're calling on anyone who might be in earshot of this interview at this time?
I think in terms of support I got, I don't really know if I got really a lot of support, but I know the Native youth movement. I know my daughters started working with some of the groups in Vancouver, and started this relationship with some of the key activists in the Vancouver area, and they then introduced them to Janice and then to me, and now we sort of have an ongoing sort of relationship. But it basically involves a lot of people who dig and search for information, and they sort of set up a coalition of support for the people. I know they sort of, after they met and they came up for that convergence on August 29th of this year, I know a lot of them really realized the magnitude of this Sun Peak ski resort and how destructive it is to the environment, and I guess really realize what kind of big real estate deal it is, and how it really has very little or no effect with regard to recreation and tourism. This has to be contrasted though with the local Shuswap chiefs who have said they did not support the protest on the 29th of August. We need support, I think, to review the interlocutory injunction that has been put on us. There are some serious questions that are raised by this. First of all, I think there is a strong argument on our part with regard to our economic interests that just are not taken into consideration when the Supreme Court considers these issues. And that's something that not only impacts on us as Indigenous people, but it impacts on a lot of other Indigenous people, plus probably even environmental organizations, because they really look at just the financial benefit that industry like Sun Peaks will have, and so it's important to fight that, and I'm going to suggest that we appeal that decision. Despite they're pretty difficult to overturn, I think nevertheless the arguments have to be heard at a higher level, simply because I feel they were totally ignored at this point. And at least try another level to see if we can start hammering away at changing the whole balance of convenience argument that has always been in the favor of commercial industry. I think that at the economic level, sustainability and traditional values, knowledge, and activities are very important new developments in those areas. And I know with regard to the Blundland Report and in terms of the Convention on Biological Diversity, and a number of economic tests that have been developed, these interests that we're talking about should start entering the domestic field, especially in terms of balance of convenience, and they shouldn't just be thrown out the door like as if they don't count at all, because there is credibility, and I think we need to build on it, the same as with the WTO and the NAFTA acceptance of the INET, or Indigenous Network on Economies and Trades brief regarding subsidies. I think those all give credibility to the argument that judges have to start waking up to the fact that we're not talking about development in the 1800s. We're talking about development in 2004. We're not talking about a period in the 1800s where there is total abundance of resources because of Indigenous sustainable practices. What we need to do is we're talking about 2004, where the forests and they have been totally destroyed by the BC forestry laws. We're talking about trying to change and reverse that destruction. And I think that the balance of convenience has to bring in these new values that are emerging. So I think that's where I'm saying there has to be some support that we'd like in that relationship. There also is the question of challenging the trespass, because the province actually issued a trespass notice, but in court they didn't want to stand on the trespass notice. They wanted to argue social interest arguments, like the behavior of the people living at the camp and their supporters. They didn't want to get into trespass because they know they're on pretty shaky ground trying to charge people who own the land with trespass, so they want to dodge that issue. And of course there's the question, a serious question about them. They never ever did consult or accommodate with regard to the approval of phase two, which is the addition of another 10,000 bed units. They never did talk to us about that. So we do need a lot of support. Some of these issues need to be addressed, because when we get out on the land, that's how they come at us, through the courts. And right now, I guess the other thing that's really important, especially in terms of the review of the interlocutory injunction, is that if you're Indian now, and if you go to Sun Peaks, or even if you're not, if you're not Indian, like if somebody from Montreal came with me up there, we could be stopped immediately by the RCMP, and we could be questioned. And if they suspect that we're going to camp in the Sun Peaks baseland area, they can arrest us and they can charge us with contempt of court. I mean, that's sort of giving basically the court order that was given out on Friday is basically an arrest order. It basically provides the RCMP with instructions or orders to stop people basically and to question them and actually arrest them. And the thing is that with Indian people, I know any time they are confronted with a prohibition order that's to be administered by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, they're awfully nervous. It will actually be a no Indians allowed kind of area. And it'll be an Indian-free zone for developers and Sun Peaks real estate agents. So that's basically what that court order is going to do. And if you don't challenge it, you know, you're going to be allowing that sort of serious breach of political rights to demonstrate for Indigenous people.
Art Manuel, I want to thank you very much for joining us on this edition of the program.
Thank you.
We were just listening to Arthur Manuel, an international representative for the Skekuquelt Protection Center, who is working to stop development at Sun Peaks Resort. To find out more about reversing the no Indian policy at Sun Peaks, visit apc.resist.ca. Back issues and subscriptions of Native Solidarity News are available at cost or for exchange. Visit the website to see our catalog, www.ckut.ca/msn.
And the hosts on that segment were Gretchen King and Dan Singh. Thanks to CKUT for that excerpt from their weekly program, Native Solidarity News. For Voices Without Frontiers and AMARC, the World Association of Community Radio Broadcasters, I'm Frieda Worden at CJSF-FM in Burnaby, British Columbia, Canada.